Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Whether it is the latest and greatest in tractors or combines or spraying technology that identifies the weeds and only sprays the weeds, or the latest engines in tractors that are 20% more efficient than the previous generation.
Kurt Blade, Senior Vice President, Association of Equipment Manufacturers.
And then other interesting things like robotic milking that allows for a small farm to be more operationally efficient, but also be able to be to address some of the labor concerns that might exist today. And then finally, we've got some cutting-edge technologies of robots, robotic planter that's a prototype that's on display here that shows kind of what the future could look like, where tractors are operating off a battery and go back to charge in a single row at a time.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Number one, it is hard to overstate the importance of free trade to American agriculture.
South Dakota Representative, member of the House Ag Committee, Dusty Johnson.
Jane mentioned that it's at 20% of overall ag output, and that's true. But for many geographies and for many products, it's bigger than that. For instance, South Dakota soybeans, 60% of our soybeans go overseas. Just a hugely important part of the South Dakota farm economy. And I think that we have real opportunity to grow that. I mean, if you had to ask me whether or not that 20%, that one out of five, is going to go up or down over the course of the next 5 or 10 years, I would be very, very bullish on the fact that it is headed up. Because we know that the world is hungry for our ag materials. And I think there's just tremendously good news ahead. So that's number one. Well, number two, to realize that potential growth, we have got to get a vision. We need a game plan. And, you know, notwithstanding the nice announcement about the UK-US trade agreement here a day or two ago, I mean, I would view that as relatively modest. Now, listen, I get it. If you make American whiskey or if you're in American tobacco, this is a relatively big deal for you. But there is a lot more out there that we can get done. And I'm a little concerned that it's March, not March of last year, but March of 2022. We still don't have a chief ag negotiator. We don't have a USDA undersecretary for trade and foreign agriculture. We do not have these basic building blocks in place. And so to the extent that any of you are ever talking to anybody with the administration, remind them that the clock is ticking. You know, perhaps one third of the time that Joe Biden is going to have to be president has already expired. And if we're going to realize these gains that we talked about in point number one, we got to have our team on the field. So number three, where we're at right now is not good. We have seen a relatively substantial loss of markets because of the supply chain crunch. And I suspect many of the viewers today, Jane, are feeling that acutely. I think the numbers are that 21% of American ag sales last year were lost, or what they could have been were lost because of the supply chain crunch. This is a serious problem. We know because of history that you can lose these markets. You can lose these customers overnight, but it takes years to build them back up. And so ag processors, ag manufacturers, ag producers, they are looking to us to get it right, because they know the system right now is going to cost them money. You just look at one industry, American dairy, you look over only 6 months, these supply chain crunches cost them $1.3 billion. And I feel it in my backyard, at Valley Queen, they're a dairy processor out of Milbank, South Dakota. You know, they had 2 million pounds of lactose that they could not get onto a container. And we can blame the supply chain crunch, but the reality is that 60% of containers that went back to Asia last year went back empty. At some point, we've got to hold these foreign flagged ocean carriers accountable. They have the space. They won't let us put our stuff in it. And that hurts trade. That hurts markets. That hurts customers. So that brings me to my last point, Jane. Number four, help is on the way. You mentioned the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. This is the Garamendi-Johnson plan. John Garamendi, Democrat from California, myself, Republican from South Dakota. And this does have momentum. This would hold foreign flagged ocean carriers accountable. This would tell them they are not allowed to unfairly discriminate against American agricultural goods. It would tell them that if they use American ports, they subject themselves to some basic rules of the road. They are common carriers. We need to have them act like it for the good of American agriculture.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Number one, we're going to breeding season. I mean, that's what the pasture is for, spring calving cows. And so we need to protect those cows against the major reproductive infectious diseases. And so we want to protect them against IBR, the two BVDs, lepto. And then the V on our vaccine stands for Vibrio. It's actually a new name called Campylobacter. But those are the four organisms that we actually want to protect those cows from during that breeding season to maximize our efficiency there.
And that's Dr. Greg Hanselcheck, Kansas State veterinarian on timing of turnout.
We've always said in the past that we want those vaccines to go in those cows, and it can be killed or modified live, 30 to 45 days before bull turnout or before we AI them, because we need to give them enough time to respond. And there are some mild and transitory negative impacts of especially modified live on the fertility. But some of the latest information from some of our bovine immunologists suggests that it shouldn't be 30 to 45 days. It should be 45 to 60 days before the breeding season. So that just means we have to start a little bit earlier in the spring before we go to pasture.
And he says there's one often overlooked aspect of the operation, the bulls.
I really think that sometimes we forget about the bulls, whether it's deworming or fly control or vaccinations, but it is important to protect them against these same diseases. And so easy recommendation is to just treat the bulls like you do the cows. Use the same vaccine, use the same vaccination schedule, and that helps protect them. And everybody knows you have a bull that goes bad or becomes infertile or whatever due to a disease, the impact on the herd is a lot more than one cow that becomes infertile. And so, yeah, we need to make sure those bulls are getting the right vaccination program.
And it starts simply with a breathing soundness exam.
We're not going to identify bulls that are sterile. What we're trying to do is identify those bulls that are less fertile and to get them out of the herd before the breeding season. So it has a lot of limitations. All we can do is look at the sperm particularly and some of the anatomy of the bull. What it won't assess is the libido of the bull and the bull's ability to actually do the breeding. And so we recommend do the breeding soundness exam, and then when the producer's out in the pasture checking calves and cows for health, make sure you're watching the bulls, make sure that they have the desire to breed and the fact that they can anatomically also breed, because we have several cases of that every year.
And says when you're focusing on the first calf heifers,
the baseline, most people would say, let's give them the Clostridium 7-way to protect them against some of the purple gut, the overeating, and those kind of things. If herds that have had problems with, unfortunately, a more common and relatively new health issue called pasture pneumonia or pre-breeding pneumonia, those herds are probably going to need to do something different as far as vaccination for those calves. We don't have that disease figured out. So to say if there's a baseline or a blanket vaccination program is wrong, just recommend that they work with their veterinarian and say, hey, we have this problem when we go to pasture or later in the pasture season. What can we do vaccination-wise to prevent it?
Yeah, respiratory concern should be considered here then.
And it is a respiratory disease. So whether they add the manhymias and the pastorellas and some of those respiratory organisms, that's between them and the veterinarian.
Make sure you have dewormers ready.
And there's three products out there, and those are the oral dewormers. So we'd want an oral dewormer and then an injectable or a pour-on at the same time. And that's not only are we going to – they act on different worms at different stages. We'll do a lot better job of keeping the pastures clean, but we're going to reduce the amount of resistance also.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We look at the deficit for the end of the 2019-2020 crop. The world production consumption surplus was, 17, 18 million bales, and it was forecast to drop down to just below 5 million bales. So that was very, very helpful.
Gerald Nieper is president of TrueCot, Bakersfield, California, on China returning to the U.S. cotton market.
You run into the July time period, prices continue to increase for a 13-week stretch of time. China purchased 2.2 million bales of U.S. cotton, 1.3 for the 29 crop year, 900,000 bales for 2020. Phase one looks to be a success.
Positive news from outside the industry that really fueled the fire.
We continue with the December contract. That continued to climb, finally breaching 70 cents, late October, early November. December 14th, the United States coronavirus death toll surpassed 300,000 people. But more importantly, which is what was giving people hope at this time, Sarah Linsley, on that day, a nurse in New York, became the first American outside a clinical trial to receive the COVID-19 vaccine, which was set into high motion, you know, early in the beginning of this this pandemic. What was also happening with the USDA numbers between USDA, you know, consumption with production was coming down a little bit. Consumption was rising some. World-ending stocks were, while not falling as much as we'd like to see, you know, they were still coming down. By December 2020, world production was reduced 5.1 million barrels from the original May forecast. U.S. production was coming down 3.6 million barrels. They started out at 19.5, eventually ended up around 14.6 million barrels. December 21, 2020, U.S. Congress passed the second COVID Relief Act, which went to former President Trump for approval. It was approved, and it promised another $600 per eligible individual. More importantly, the world production consumption surplus was declining. Wasn't in deficit area yet, but it was well below the previous year. We get into the March 21 contract, and that just continued the trajectory of an upward sloping price curve. March 13, 2021, U.S. surpassed 100 million vaccinations. It's not 100 million people, but 100 million vaccinations had been administered. March 21, a third round of stimulus checks go out. People have more money to spend. People were getting vaccinated. Things are opening up. You know, it was all hunky-dory from that period forward. You go into the Jan-Feb-March time period, world consumption, you know, was lifted another million barrels, now a million barrels above the original May 2020 forecast. Meanwhile, production was lowered 800,000, now 6.6 million barrels below the original forecast. Ending stocks were dropping. The world production consumption, we are in a deficit now, approaching 5 million barrels. So things are certainly tightening up around the world as the world gets back to work and people want to go and spend some of their stimulus money. We move into the April-May time period. USDA comes up with their newest forecast, or their initial forecast for the 22 crop year. World production is up, yes. It's up about 6 million barrels. More importantly, though, consumption continues to climb. They've got consumption up another 4 million barrels. World-ending stocks are down. So from February 11, 2021 to April 1st, 2021, the U.S. sold 1.7 million barrels to the export market. April 21, the U.S. surpassed 200 million vaccinations being administered.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Brazil is the top importer of Russia fertilizers.
University of Illinois ag economist Joanna Colucci.
Brazil is the fourth largest fertilizer importer in the world and is responsible for 8% of global consumption. And about a fifth of Brazilian imports come from Russia. Adding in fertilizer from Belarus raises the amount imported by Brazil to nearly 30%. The most significant dependence is on potash. Russia and Belarus account for 44% of the potash imported by Brazil. The country gets most of its potash from Canada. Brazil imports 95% of its nitrogen fertilizer needs, and Russia is the leading supplier, accounting for 21% of the amount imported, followed by China, Qatar, and Algeria. Brazil imports 75% of its phosphate needs, the lowest percentage of the three essential fertilizer components. The main supplier is Morocco, followed by Russia, Saudi Arabia, the United States, and China. The U.S. is the third largest fertilizer importer in the world, and is responsible for 10% of global consumption, behind China and India. Unlike Brazil, the United States has a robust fertilizer industry. However, it could still be affected by global supply and demand. In 2021, the U.S. imported about 93% of the potash needed for healthy crops. Canada provides 83% of the potash used in the United States. Russia and Belarus provide 12% used in the U.S. in 2021. Belarus is a red subject to European and U.S. sanctions restricting its potash exports. Together, Russia and Belarus control 40% of the potash supply in the world. The American dependence on nitrogen and phosphate imports is much smaller, 12% and 9% respectively. On March 2021, Brazil announced plans to support additional fertilizer production to address rising costs. The program aims to reduce Brazilian fertilizer imports from 85% to 45% by 2050. The plan includes a new fiscal policy for the sector and provides support for private firms to expand fertilizer production capacity. In 2021, Brazil imported more than 41 million tons of fertilizers, a record, 21% more than last year. The increase in consumption is mainly pushed by the growth of acreage over the last few years. Also in March, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced it would support additional fertilizer production for American farmers to address rising costs. This summer, the USDA will provide $250 million through a new grant program to support American fertilizer production.
University of Illinois Ag economist Joanna Colucci. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Vaccines are tools that are intended to be used to build immunity prior to the onset of disease so that the animal's immune system is prepared to respond once it's faced with a specific challenge.
Dr. Jason Smith is a Texas AgriLife Extension beef cattle specialist.
That challenge may be a bacterium, a virus, a protozoan, or some other pathogen, depending upon the specific vaccine. Vaccines are intended to be used to prevent a problem rather than to be used to treat an active infection. So when designed and used appropriately, vaccination programs allow you as a beef cattle producer to be proactive at preventing health problems rather than needing to be reactive and respond to an existing health issue that may have been preventable through the proper use of a vaccine.
But says not all vaccines work in the same way.
Some vaccines are effective at preventing disease, while others may only be effective at reducing the severity of disease. Typical vaccination programs are targeted toward building immunity against respiratory, clostridial, and reproductive diseases, to name a few, and may include either solely or some combination of modified live, killed, or otherwise inactivated vaccines. Vaccine programs are not one size fits all, and therefore they should not be treated as such. What works for your neighbor's operation may not be ideal for yours. Similarly, what has worked for yours in the past may need to be revised and updated, and arguably should evolve over time.
But of course, there's the importance of your veterinarian.
Your veterinarian should play an integral role in helping to develop or redesign a vaccination program that best fits the needs of your operation. Your veterinarian should absolutely be consulted when determining which specific vaccines to use, as they're most likely the best positioned to provide information on the specific pathogens that should be of concern to your operation.
Talks about determining which vaccines are most important.
Some factors to consider when determining which pathogens or diseases to vaccinate your cattle against include the potential likelihood of exposure, the risk that exposure presents, and its expected impact to your operation. Other important factors to consider include the duration of immunity that's expected to be provided by the vaccine, so whether or not it should be expected to provide immunity or protection during the time in which the cattle are expected to be challenged, as well as if the vaccines are compatible with one another in terms of timeline to boostering or revaccination when more than one vaccine will be administered at a single time.
and the importance of reading the label.
Beyond the initial design or revision of a vaccination program, it's important to recognize that the means in which vaccines are handled, stored, and administered are key to ensure success of the vaccination program. It doesn't matter how comprehensive that program is if we unintentionally do something to render the vaccine ineffective. The product label is an often overlooked but critically important resource that should be read and followed in order to ensure that vaccines are handled, stored, and administered in ways that will help to ensure that they work as intended. Please note that some vaccines have restrictions against use in certain production classes, such as pregnant cows, calves nursing pregnant cows, or calves prior to a certain age, just to name a few examples.
Dr. Jason Smith, Texas AgriLife Extension Beef Cattle Specialist. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
When we look at the amount of moisture that we received, probably anywhere from a half an inch to over an inch around the panhandle region, depending on the rain that came prior to the snow, and then, of course, the moisture equivalent from the snowfall event.
That's Dr. Jordan Bell, Texas AgriLife Extension Grain Specialist, but says spring planting could be affected by the ongoing drought.
So as producers are considering the drought, the forecast, they're really making some hard decisions about this year's summer cropping decisions. Fortunately, we have some producers who still have some irrigation to help them meet in-season demands, but we are even seeing that where producers have irrigation, it is not enough in many cases to get by unless they are managing that acreage appropriately, meaning that they're reducing their irrigated acreage. But then that leaves very hard decisions about what to do with the remaining acreage. We have more dry land acreage in many areas than we previously had due to declining well capacities. And as we consider a lack of soil moisture, poor precipitation forecasted through the spring, above average temperatures forecasted through the spring, it really creates some hard decisions for producers and how they're going to manage that planted acreage. And many producers are considering cotton as well as grain sorghum because of the drought tolerance of both of those crops. But even in those cases, as we consider a lack of soil moisture and not enough rainfall forecasted to get these crops up, it's really going to be a very tough spring unless we see a shift in weather patterns.
So maybe the question is, how will expensive inputs drive the conversation for acres in 2022?
Yeah, that's a very real question and a very tough question that many producers are having to ask. Of course, when we talk about inputs, fertilizer and herbicides are two things that are coming to everyone's mind. When we look at the cost of fertilizer right now, one thing that producers can and should do is soil sample. And if producers have a better understanding of what they have in the soil, as well as the yield goal that they are projecting, it might give them a better idea of how much fertilizer, or it will give them a better idea of how much fertilizer they can actually apply without over-applying. And as we consider soil sampling, the cost of soil sampling, it really becomes a very minor input cost that can potentially save producers thousands of dollars in unnecessary fertilizer expenses. Now, when we talk about soil sampling, producers are generally sampling 0 to 6, 0 to 8 inches. And if we're really going to capture the amount of nitrogen and other nutrients that are in a profile, a producer should be sampling deeper, 24 to even 36 inches if possible. Now, that is easier said than done because it is harder to get those deep cores. But again, that would provide producers the understanding about how much nutrient is actually in that profile, how much they can credit towards this crop, and a better idea of how much fertilizer they actually need. And then, of course, though, it does become, I think, really important just to pencil out where the return is going to be this year. Because when we consider the economic impact from higher fertilizer prices and higher input costs all the way around, producers might need to reevaluate where their greatest net return is going to be.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
2 days of discussion about and observation of trade.
Yesterday, we visited the port of Baltimore and saw concrete evidence of the close trade relationship between our two countries. Today, we toured Fearless Tech, a local software company that is using technology to make organizations more efficient and effective in this digital economy that we have.
Wrapped up Tuesday in Baltimore between U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai and United Kingdom Secretary of State for International Trade, Anne-Marie Trevelyan. As Ambassador Tai noted,
this is not the end. In fact, this is the start of a very important conversation that will continue in the weeks and months to come.
Secretary Trevelyan added the conversations this week began efforts on
how we can take our trade partnership to the next level, deepening and diversifying what's already the strongest bilateral relationship on Earth, worth more than $200 billion last year.
I'm Ryan Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.